Good evening, you all. This is K2 Romeo India Whiskey. This time I begin the K2LIW monologue. That's what it's called. I never realized that's what it is. Johnny Carson and Jay Leno could have a monologue. Can we have a monologue? Well, we don't have the humor that they do. Ain't so humorous what goes on with ham radio, but it's certainly interesting. The TechNet is a gathering of people who are seriously interested in the hobby, want to know more about it. They discuss it with each other. They transfer information. That's what amateurs really do. They communicate. That's the major purpose of ham radio from my point of view. Communication between people, between nations. An awful lot of men's problems, of mankind's problems, can be solved that way with good communication. TechNet gathers people every Sunday for a few hours, quite a few hours, quite often, and questions get posed. We usually have no assigned subject for a particular TechNet. Let me drop. The subjects being discussed are the subjects that are brought to the net as a question. A tremendous amount of brain power in the New York City area, portions of New Jersey, Connecticut, Southern New York State, and Long Island. There are people who wish they lived in Silicon Valley because they think there's a lot of progress going on there, a lot of good education. Count the number of educational institutions and the amount of high-tech companies that are here, and we certainly are giving them a serious challenge, even though we may not have invented Moore's Law and the companies that are making the actual integrated circuit chips. The usual agenda for the TechNet is we take check-ins at the very beginning. Those are the people who go on a list, and we handle them in the order in which they sign in, or sometimes a slight modification if the person has a particular difficulty of waiting around. We make a sincere effort that within the first hour or so, we give each of those people at least a brief answer to their particular question. For those who need more in-depth data, that takes place beyond the first section of the TechNet. That first section consists of the pure ham radio questions and answers, followed by John KC2WGB's Mel's Corner, or whatever you want to call it, the Dropbox. But what we're really talking about is the people who are in the process of getting their license, the method by which they can send emails to John, and John will take the questions that are the most interesting of the group and bring them to the net, and we discuss them. We give those particular people priority because they don't have the usual way of getting to the TechNet. The main operation of the TechNet is a live, on-the-spot audio communication. It's not intended to be a written consulting service free of charge. There's a good example about what we all have to be careful of. Every minute or so, we have to create an interruption to make sure that the machine, the W2VL machine, 146.85, gets a chance to reset. It's linked to a machine out east in Selden, and it has to reset. It needs to link between the two, which is either EchoLink or IRLP, plus the people who try to sign in by EchoLink or IRLP because they live out of the area. They have a considerable amount of difficulty because of the dropouts of the machine when we get overly enthusiastic and jumping on top of each other. We don't wait for all four beeps in between those drops so that all the machines can reset. The person in the remote area has the problem periodically of whatever he's listening to gets timed out, and therefore he's hearing the conversation intermittently. It is my belief that that's one of the major reasons that people become discouraged with trying to sign in from week after week in the outer areas. After John goes through his interesting emails that he gets from the beginning students of ham radio, occasionally hearing some piss in the background. After that, the Paul WS2N will, as our space expert, tell us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. Let me drop. Beyond those first three items, then we go into the more serious discussion, which can be a question a person asked where he needs more in-depth information, and we weren't able to give that significant number of advanced European scientists where they're investigating certain behavior of let's call it a I'm going to call it a Tesla coil-like machine. In other words, a machine that has a combination of high voltage arcing and the way that circuitry behaves and the way you make measurements of power input and power output. There are people who, in Europe, learned people who believe they see excess power being generated by that technique. Of course, there are many people that are skeptical, and quite possibly it's not going to be a successful experiment. That's okay. The process of investigating it, finding ways of testing it, confirming it, and really learning how to use fairly exotic instrumentation that's now available to certainly engineers and for the well-equipped amateur radio operators or amateur electronic enthusiasts. They can learn better and better ways of using that machinery in the process of confirming or denying that perception, that concept. It doesn't have to be guaranteed to be successful. So this material, without a doubt, only appeals to a smaller portion of the audience. Let me drop it. And therefore, it's discussed late at night when ordinarily the machine would be silent. There are people who wish that situation didn't exist, that material didn't exist. They say they would rather listen to silence than listen to that material. That's a hard concept to understand what's going on there. Is that a control issue? Is that just someone displeased that amateurs are discussing that kind of material? I mean, it's not hurting anybody. It's not doing any real damage. And one of the things that we're modifying, and that's one of the things that John brought to my attention tonight, the TechNet is an evolving protocol of what ham radio operators do. By that I mean the TechNet and the schedule, the protocol that we follow, changes from time to time. If you know of a better method by which we could gather, share information, discuss it properly, communicate with each other, how much time we should devote to each one of those sections, if you've got an opinion and you want to express it, certainly do that. There are multiple ways by which you can do it. There is something that Bernie, KQYO, has created called the Dropbox, by which you can bring information to the net. Now, when it comes to one of the complaints we received, which is possibly a valid complaint, and that is sometimes the discussions late at night take place by which various people are looking at a particular website, a particular YouTube video, a particular schematic diagram, and discussing it. And we've now started making the promise that before that kind of material is being discussed, we're going to make a sincere effort to make sure everyone knows what is that website address, how can they get access to it, by way of KQYO's email system. That's one of the methods by which people can find out what's going to be discussed tonight. I mean, if you want to go to that particular website, follow along with that particular discussion, look at that exact same picture at the same time. That's 2.5 minutes into that recording, so to speak, and therefore know what's going on. We're going to make a sincere effort to make that information available to you. I think I've covered most of those concepts that I wanted to cover tonight. Let me turn it over to John to make sure. John, have I skipped anything I should be saying? KC2WGV, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGV. No, Dick, you just about covered it. I, in fact, at 7:20, I emailed Bernie the composite for tonight. I'm sure he'll have that on his website ready to go out to people if they request it. With the Dropbox, I don't know how that's going to work because they have to have that mounted on their desktop to be able to do that, which can be done, but they would have to contact Bernie on that. But other than that, you've covered it all. But the information is out there. I tried to call Bernie a couple of times. No response yet, but I'm sure he picked it up.
Thank you, John. As you can tell, some of the details of how the Dropbox works.
One more thing, if I can, Dick.
Go ahead, John. I was going to say that some of the details of the Dropbox are not completely worked out yet. That's being refined. Go ahead, John.
I think, as you know, on QRZ, my website is there. If they have any recommendations for the TechNet, they can even send that to me, and I will forward that to Bernie to be posted. If I'll take on that responsibility, too, just to keep it, try to make it a little smoother for everybody.
give you that offer, John. So if you go to QRZ.com, dial in John's call letters, KC2WGB. You'll find his call letters. You'll find his phone number eventually. You'll find anything you want to know about John and how to communicate with him in order to give him emails that are a question, in order to give him emails that are a suggestion as to what you believe is a better way that the technique should evolve, how we should, what process we should follow in the beginning, and the protocol, as they call it. Okay, let's begin. At this time, we're going to take in check-ins. Check-ins are people who do have a question or a comment. They're going to give me their call letters. They're going to give me and John their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment. If you're just listening, you need not to, you need that check-in. I mean, in the very beginning, the technique used to consist of a long list of people who were saying, I'm listening. By now, after 29 years of the TechNet, which has received a national award, thank goodness John KC2RFN nominated us for that award, and the TechNet won that award a year and a half ago, a national award.
That was Alan Dick.
Did I call him something else? Alan KC2RFN? Is that what you're saying, John?
Yeah, you said John.
I got John on the brain here, John. Okay, so Alan nominated us for that award, and I forget what I was going to say, but thank goodness that that took place, and as such, the TechNet does have must have, in order to survive for 29 years, there must be a large number of listeners somewhere, and we eventually make it easier. There's going to be a radio link set up eventually between the East Coast machine, the West Coast machine, and the Internet connection between the two, which is the troublesome one, because sometimes it's got a time delay of an eighth of a second, and sometimes it's got a time delay of 3 or 4 seconds. And that creates a problem when it comes to people out of the area signing in. That's eventually going to be replaced by a radio link, and that's being worked on by Andy, the A2CDL, and when that becomes operational, some of the problems that you've been hearing about are going to be alleviated. So give me a call, letters, your name, and the word yes, because you do have a question or comment at this time. K2RIW.
AK1NS. Dave, yes.
Professor Atkins there. Thank you, Dave. Anyone else?
KC2RFN. Alan, yes.
There's the guy who did it all. Okay. Alan's the second one. Who's the third?
KC2BHY, yes.
And I bet you that guy's name is Jim. And thank you for shining in, Jim. Anyone else?
K2BMP, Joe, yes.
Now, let me make sure I got that correctly. I think his name is Jay. K2 Baker, Mike Tango, is that true?
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Mike Papa, Joe.
My goodness, did I get that one wrong? Good thing I double-checked. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Mike Tango, I think that was. Repeat that for me again, Joe.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Mike Papa.
Okay, Joe, I have trouble reading my own writing. It's part of what's going on here. Let's see. You're number 4. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW. Okay, we have more than enough to get started. KD1, November Sierra. Go right ahead, sir. K2RIW.
Good evening to the net, and it's AK1NS Dave. And an interesting little antenna experiment been conducted over the last week here using ham sticks as dipoles. And I picked up a pair of 80-meter and a pair of 160-meter mobile ham sticks, and I picked them up as both vertically and horizontally as dipoles. And some interesting results coming back with pretty good SWRs across them and getting contacts pretty much from Bangor, Maine to North Dakota, which is odd at 100 watts. But I'm wondering if it would, and I haven't put them up on the roof yet. They're 10 feet HEL on a patio umbrella stand. And I'm thinking I'd run them up about 30 feet. Would I benefit mounting them horizontally or vertically? I've read a lot of stuff on the internet that's conflicting. And adding capacitor heads, would that improve the performance? And is this thing actually functioning as an MVIS antenna? I don't know. Sometimes if I mount it horizontally, it seems that it is. Vertically, it doesn't. But back to you. Thank you.
K1NS, K2RIW. I'm having trouble reading my own writing. The QRZ.com lists you as William D. Atkins. Does the D stand for Dave or Dan? I can't read my own writing. That's a quick question first, sir. Go ahead.
Comment. Dave, go ahead.
Very fine, Dave. On comment, you have a point of order. Go ahead.
This is November 2, Romeo Delta Bravo, Tim. yes, referring to Dave, that his antenna is behaving in an NVIS manner when he has it low mounted like that on the patio.
Very fine, Tim. Dave, what you're doing is a beautiful science experiment that you didn't realize. You are confirming, reconfirming, doing a real measurement that is giving us proof that an infinitesimal dipole-like structure can have full performance. You look in all the really good books telling you how to set up a ham radio antenna. An 80-meter dipole will be shown as a piece of wire that's as high as you can mount it in your backyard, approximately 132 feet long, usually split in the center with a center insulator, usually fed with the feed line at that point, hopefully with a balun, but not necessarily. So 132-foot long half-wave dipole is a full-performance antenna. You get on the 20-meter, 40-meter band any day of the week, the 80-meter band, and you tell people that you're experimenting with antennas that are physically smaller than 132 feet. Good common sense will tell them that as the antenna becomes smaller, the performance is going to degrade, your effective capture area is going to degrade, the gain is going to go down, and the bandwidth over which you can use the antenna is going to go down. Most of those things that people quote for smaller than full-size dipoles are not true. Opposite of common sense. Let me drop. If I was smart enough to take my 132-foot dipole and squeeze it down to smaller and smaller physical lengths by coiling it into helical-type radiator, by putting top-hat capacitors, by putting loading coils at the bottom, middle, top, by zigzagging it, all kinds of ways I can physically make the antenna smaller, but continue to resonate it. And to continue to resonate it, I can be doing it with mechanical means, like I just described, or by putting an antenna tuner of some kind, and if I'm smart enough to use low-loss materials at that antenna tuner, and mount the antenna tuner in the best of all worlds, right at the antenna, in theory, I could make that 80-meter dipole. It should be 132 feet long. I could probably make it 5 or 10 feet long total with proper impedance matching devices. I will get the exact same efficiency. In other words, 98% of the watts I put into it will be radiated into space. The antenna pattern will be very close to the dipole pattern you get from 132 feet of wire. The pattern changes a little bit in that the figure eight pattern, the way it's usually plotted, the broadside pattern, becomes a little bit fatter, which means you're still putting the same amount of energy in space. You're putting it into slightly different areas. The gain falls down by half a dB broadside, and but there's more angles over which you cover. Now that antenna has a phase center, as the antenna engineer will call it. In other words, when you stand away from that antenna at a far enough distance and you measure where you think the signal is coming from, every antenna has an electronic phase center. As you place that phase center further above the ground, what happens is that the mirror image of the real antenna above the ground and the mirror image of the antenna below the ground, you stand off a mile away and you've got radio eyes that operate at that frequency and you look back at the antenna, you're going to see a real antenna above the ground and one below the ground. If it's horizontally polarized, the signal that reflects off the ground, the mirror image signal, turns out to give another 180 degree approximately phase shift on ground reflection. Those two signals going out to the horizon tend to give you a cancellation because they're out of phase with each other. As you start going high enough up in your helicopter, a mile away where you're doing the testing of the pattern out of this antenna, pretty soon the extra path length down to the mirror image antenna compared to the real antenna above the ground, that path length gets longer as you raise yourself up in your testing helicopter. Pretty soon that out of phase signal goes back in phase, and that is the peak angle of your radiation. You set that peak angle by setting the number of feet above the ground where the phase center is located. So by setting the altitude of the antenna, you're setting the altitude at which the major signal angle comes off, the vertical elevation angle. Altitude does it. Choose an altitude that's a half wavelength or so, and down below, that angle turns out to be straight up in the air, a nevus near vertical incident sky wave. If you want to have short range QSOs, you set the antenna closest to the ground. Let me drop. And should you set these antennas, these physically small antennas, should you set them horizontally polarized or vertically polarized to get the best performance? The answer is yes. Do both. On the assumption they're not super expensive, you have the resources, as I see it, Dave, to mount some horizontal, some vertical, some of them favoring east-west, some of them favoring north-south, maybe mount some of them at a 45-degree angle. By having separate feed lines or a switchable relay on your one feed line so that you can select which of those antennas you're using today, you're going to find some very pleasant surprises. When you're talking to your buddy in London, today maybe the vertical works better than the horizontal. When you're transmitting, and maybe the opposite antenna works better when you're receiving. Because the signals getting to London have to get there by reflecting off the ionosphere, and because the ionosphere on almost every day of the week is going to give you what's called Faraday polarization rotation. A signal that bounces off the ionosphere doesn't just bounce. It really penetrates into the ionosphere, goes through it for a certain length of time, gets a curved path, and comes back out again. And you and I call that a bounce. It's actually a more complicated phenomenon. That ionosphere is a plasma. The interaction of your radio signal, that plasma, and the Earth's magnetic field creates rotation. The signal that you transmit on Long Island might arrive in London vertical, even though you transmitted it horizontal. And when it comes back in the other direction, it doesn't obey reciprocity. Faraday rotation behaves differently when the signal is going from east to west or when the signals go from west to east. So I can see there's a bunch of random variables being thrown in here, done by Mother Nature, and as you set up some of these horizontal, some of these vertical, switch between the two, recognizes the difference between transmitting and receiving, you can have a grand old time with this thing. You're on the beginning of a beautiful science experiment, as you can tell, Dave. I've probably gone off some
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
I've probably gone off subject a little bit, but you're allowed to ask more questions, and you started on a real beauty here. And as you discover how well this antenna works, very similar to what Mel, Silent Key, K2KUI, used to do. He had a kind of a very compact antenna he was using in the shack with him. And by reorienting that antenna mechanically in various directions, a very small loop antenna, he was able to get full reception. He could choose the direction of arrival. He could choose all kinds of things with this antenna. He was afraid to transmit with it because it was closely located to him. But very small antennas, properly designed, properly deployed, can give you full performance, per se, within a half a dB of that 132-foot long thing that you hang 100 feet in the air. As you see, there's a lot of things you can play with here, Dave. AK1MS, K2RIW, thank you for bringing that to our attention.
I'll throw one more thing out at you real quick. I did put it on an antenna rotator, and I also made the bracket assembly pivot so that I can orient it horizontally or vertically from a distance. And this is where I ran into a little issue. I had one coax feed line, I'm using 8X, go up and essentially using a co-phase harness attaches to both of the SO230 non-connectors, and I found the SWR problem was quite bad. I solved it by running independent 8X to each antenna and just switching between them when I wanted to go from 160 to 80. The literature seems to say that you should be able to use one coax feed line and that the RF signal is going to take the path of least resistance at all times. And, for instance, if it's at 80 meters or 75 meters, it's going to naturally want to go that route. But what I observed was not entirely happening. It seemed like a little of that was going into the other antenna system and messing up the SWR. So do I need to stick with the two coax feed lines, or is there a better idea?
Yeah, you're into a very interesting other concept going on here, Dave. And that is, let me drop. was a conventional long dipole out of wire, 132 feet for the 80-meter one, and I guess it's 264 feet for the 160-meter one, and maybe 65 feet for the 40-meter one, a conventional fan dipole. With a little bit of the right amount of spreading at the tips of those dipoles becomes an automatic switching arrangement. In other words, the RF energy with one piece of coax going to all those dipoles that all come together at one common center insulator, the RF energy selects the right antenna to go down and ignores all the others because the others have a very high reactive standing wave ratio. Therefore, they represent almost an open impedance, and only 1% of the energy goes down those, and 99% goes down the right one. That's when you build it with conventional dipoles. I am guessing, and we can confirm this one now, Dave, that as you start squeezing them down by various techniques, by these hamstick-like antennas, where now you've got a helical resonator, you've got a more compact resonator, a stronger amount of local magnetic field takes place in the antenna. Therefore, the coupling between the antennas, the 80-meter version and the 40-meter version, or the 80-meter version and the 160-meter version, the coupling between them, which normally is fairly well isolated in a fan dipole, I'm guessing that intercoupling increases when they're squeezed down. You can confirm that. There's various ways that you can temporarily put a separate feed line on, let's say, the 160-meter hamstick and the 80-meter hamstick, and when you transmit into one, measure how much signal is present on the other. When you do that, you're measuring the intercoupling. If this is the best of all worlds, when you transmit into the 80-meter hamstick, the 160-meter hamstick would get a signal that's 20 dB down. You know, 1% of the power is flowing into the wrong one, so to speak. When you transmit into one and measure the amount of reception power out of the second one, that's measuring cross-coupling. If you measure a cross-coupling that's only, let's pick the number, 4 dB down, which means there's a lot of intercoupling, now you know how much more complicated it is when you try to build a fan dipole out of those. The intercoupling is going to make them not act quite as isolated. There's ways of getting around that. If you're willing to build the right kind of an electronic circuit, you can create a cancellation of that cross-coupling if you want to feed it all with one feed line. I didn't say it's the easy approach, but that's another whole area of research you could go into. The brute force approach of guaranteeing exactly the performance you want would be to have separate feed lines or a relay switching arrangement, so you feed just the right one. But when you do make with separate coax cables that cross-coupling measurement, you'll know how much intercoupling you're getting. You'll know whether or not you want to correct it by physical distance or whatever, or setting them at right angles to each other. One set at east-west while the other set is north-south. That will be by polarization rotation, so to speak, create less intercoupling. So there's a whole other area of research you can do there. That's what I think you're starting to see the evidence of that. Back to you, Dave, K2RIW.
Peter, thank you very much. And just one final quick one, and that's would I benefit from these capacitor hat kits that you see in the magazines and the advertising that essentially I assume would allow me to shorten the whip a little bit, but supposedly they change the impedance and benefit that somehow, and is there some type of an additional tuning coil, or should I be using a ballon, or you know, just an air choke at the point where the coax is attached to the SO239? I currently do not have anything up there like that.
Yeah, the poor man's ballon, taking a few turns of the coax cable and taping it together right at the antenna, which acts as an RF choke so that RF energy that wants to flow back down on the outside of the coax cable doesn't get a chance to do that. That's always a good thing to do. To put in a real ballon or the poor man's ballon that I just described always is a beneficial thing to do. Whenever you do anything to physically shrink the antenna down by way of meandering it, helical winding it, loading coil, top hat capacitors, anything that physically shortens the antenna, means that the total number of feet of antenna exposed to space that does the radiating, as you shrink down that number of feet and re-resonate the antenna by various techniques, impedance matching circuit or whatever, the main thing that happens is the Q of the antenna, by the laws of physics, must increase as you make it physically shorter. Anything that makes the radiating distance exposed to space shorter makes the Q go up. That's a fancy way of saying the bandwidth of the antenna goes down. Q, one of the four or five definitions of Q is center frequency divided by the 3 dB bandwidth, and if some of these really short antennas on 80 meters might only be operational over a 50 kc bandwidth. You go outside of that bandwidth and the VSWR starts climbing real fast. So VSWR bandwidth and physical size is a trade-off. There may be some electronic means of getting around that. I mean, one brute force approach would be to make some kind of a remotely controlled antenna tuner mounted right at the antenna, where when you go to the new frequency where the VSWR is very high, you retune it, so to speak. So there's ways around that, but no matter what method you use for physically shortening the antenna, the Q will increase. And that's basic physics. I wonder if that makes some sense to you, Dave. AK1NS, K2RIW.
As always, thank you very much, and I appreciate your covering this tonight very kindly. And I'm going to continue on with it. It seems to be going well. All right, thanks again.
Question? Yeah, Alan recognized. You've started a very interesting area of research here, Dave. Come back in future weeks. Let us know how it goes, what's working well, what's not working well, and so on. You're allowed to ask more questions. Go right ahead with your question on this subject, Alan. And by the way, since, Alan, you are the next guy on the list, you can combine it with your questions on the previous subject as well as your questions. KCQRFN, the guy who created the award, KQRFN. You got it, Alan.
Good evening, Dick, KC2RFM. Just a question on this experiment. Is the idea here that these ham sticks are supposed to be monopole and Dave is forcing it to become dipole? Is that the idea?
Almost everything that we call monopole, you think it's a monopole because of what your eye sees physically, Alan. It really is a dipole. The most basic antenna really is a dipole. Your eye may not see it, but it's always a dipole. If I've got a pure monopole quarter-wave vertical radiator in my backyard, and if I'm a purist and I've laid down a zillion ground plane radials, in the process of laying down a zillion ground plane radials, I have tried to make my backyard look like a great big sheet of copper, and this quarter-wave monopole is in the middle of it, and I'm feeding it. And it's got about a 30-ohm impedance when I do that. The other half of the dipole is the mirror image of the real monopole up above, and the mirror image of it, the one below ground, below the copper sheet, if you know what I mean. There really is a dipole. We call that those ground plane radials, we call it the counterpoise, where the current is coming back out of the counterpoise into the radiator on one half the cycle. On the other half cycle, you're taking the charge out of the antenna and putting it back into the counterpoise. Or another way of looking at it, I can take a real dipole in space. At one instant of time, the right-hand side is positive, the left-hand side is negative. I can put a sheet of metal down the middle of the dipole at right angles to it, normal to it. The sheet of metal is at the neutral plane, halfway between the positive right side and the negative left-hand side on this half cycle. Putting the sheet of metal there makes no difference in the radiation pattern, the impedance. Nothing on the antenna changes when I put that sheet of metal there. Let me drop. Once I put that sheet of metal there, I realize that if I want to, I can feed the right-hand side of the dipole, reference to the sheet of metal, and throw away the left-hand side. I've now converted from dipole to monopole. But it really is a dipole, because the mirror image is still there, if you know what I mean. It's a different way of feeding it. It gives you some extra complication. Feeding a quarter-wave antenna mounted at the ground has a number of disadvantages. To really get high performance, it requires a zillion radials, and the center of radiation is really at ground level, not at a higher altitude. With a hell of a lot less resources, a guy who's got a tall tree, a tall tower, or whatever nearby, and if he simply hangs a pure, vertical, full, half-wave dipole and feeds it at the center if he wants to, and if he's real smart, he feeds it at the bottom end, he gets a zillion benefits out of doing that. Much higher performance, a higher center of radiation, and he doesn't need a zillion ground plane radials anymore. He can do with almost nothing but a simple ground stake in the ground, and the antenna will be a lot easier to install, a lot less material required, and a lot higher in performance. That antenna is very unpopular because no one has ever put that picture in the book. They always put this horizontal dipole parallel to the ground, set in the center as the diagram that you study as to what a dipole is. Everybody thinks it's got to be built exactly that way or it's going to not work, if you know what I mean. Maybe that's some of the answer you're looking for, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW.
Yeah, I understood a lot of that from prior TechNet sticks. What I'm really asking here is the ham stick, I'm assuming here, was designed to be used in the car, and the car's body was a counterpoise. Is what Dave is doing, because I'm sure he doesn't want to put a car up on his roof, he's just using an identical ham stick to act as the counterpoise. Is that the crux of what he's doing and the basis of the complications he's been running into and asking you about? But is that the crux of it, replacing the counterpoise of the car with just the identical antenna on the other side?
Now, he's going back and doing the opposite thing I described with that experiment where you put a sheet of metal on a real dipole in free space. He's now going backwards. He starts off with a monopole, an antenna that looks like it's designed to go on the sheet metal of a car, and he's now creating a counterpoise instead of a great big car up in the air. He's using another hamstick. Assuming that the hamstick itself is made out of materials that don't have a lot of insertion loss, there's no distributed resistance inside of that antenna. He's very smart to create a real dipole out of a pair of back-to-back hamsticks. He's going back to the real dipole. That's what does the basic radiating. Almost every antenna we use is in proper analysis, a dipole. That monopole in your background really is electronically a dipole because of the mirror image on the other side of the counterpoise. The little whisker you put inside of a piece of waveguide as a waveguide to coax launching structure. That is a kind of a monopole inside of the waveguide that launches the signal in the waveguide. Because of the reflection off the side of the waveguide, it is really a dipole. And some of the launching structures you'll see that do waveguide coax to adapting is really a dipole inside. So his constructing it into a dipole, you make it sound like he created the problem. From my point of view, he created a solution, a very good solution. Yeah, he's got a couple of growing pains in the way these compact, shrunk down, physical size hamsticks do create a stronger local magnetic field because of them being physically shorter. Therefore, their ability to cross couple to his 80 meter and his 160 meter ones cross couple to each other with greater alacrity than they would if they were real full size halfway dipoles in space. That's a minor problem of using a physically shortened antenna to make the structure that Dave is making. But it's a very smart thing to do, and this temporary difficulty he's having with the cross-coupling between them, there's definite solutions to that. He's on the right path, in my opinion. He's doing the right thing. He has not created a problem. He's solving a problem, from my point of view. Over to you, Al. KC2RFN, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, I wasn't criticizing it. I think it's quite clever, and looking forward to finding out how it deals with the issues. Lots of learning in that project, for sure. As for my real question, I know James is on there next. Why don't you give it to him first so that it doesn't get too late for him, and then I'll just pick it up after him if that's good with you and him. KC2RFN.
Very magnanimous, Adam Stallone. Thank you. James, you're number one on the runway right now. KD2, I'm told with my writing. Wow. DHY. You know who you are, Jim. KQI. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Dick. This week I was looking around my room and I found an old analog black and white TV. The brand is Olympia. And it works. I opened it up and checked all the circuitry and it all looked intact. And there's so much I can do with it, but I really don't know how to do it. So if you'd have any tips of what I could do with it and how I could do what you want me to do. Back to you.
What you're doing, Jim, is you're repeating a piece of history. Way back in the late 50s, I worked my way through college, Pratt Institute, studying electrical engineering, by being the only radio and television repair person in the town of Middle Island, which is about 30 miles or 20 miles east of you, out in Suffolk County. I lived there. I was a local television repair person, keeping all of those black and white, in those days, televisions operational. And so, been there, done that, if you know what I mean. You got to be a little bit careful, Jim. A black and white television set usually has something like a 250-volt power supply, is the main power supply off the main transformer. The Olympia might have that. Some of the later ones started eliminating the power transformer. But there's a power transformer, full-wave rectifier, 5U4 tube, giving you something like 250 volts. That also goes into the horizontal deflection circuit inside of that high-voltage gauge that feeds that high-voltage wire going to the side of the picture tube. And that's got something like 20,000 volts on it at a much lower current, where it can't create electrocution, the current out of the 20,000 volts, but the amount of current there and the zapping, if you touch the wrong thing with your hand, can become very unpleasant, if you know what I mean. So the 250-volt power supply, you've got to be careful. So know you're dealing with high voltage. The main advantage, let me drop. The main advantage of modern-day transistorized television sets is they run on much, much lower voltages. And particularly the ones that now have a flat screen as opposed to a cathode ray tube. So worry continuously about whether or not you're going to give yourself an electrical shock when you're doing experiments with that. Now, the high voltage deflection circuit, the way it behaves, has got a little bit of the characteristics of a Ford spark coil or the ignition circuit of a automobile. It pours current into this transformer, the high voltage transformer inside of that cage. During the horizontal sweep, current is poured into that transformer as well as the magnetic yoke assembly that does the deflection that gives you the raster scan on the screen. There's a magnetic assembly around the neck of the tube, the cathode ray tube, and so the combination of the magnetic field you put into that and the transformer inside gives you stored magnetic energy as the beam is sweeping from left to right across the screen. Then, when the dot has to go jump back from right to left, that's the time that current is not flowing into the transformer, very similar to the ignition point on your automobile coming open circuit, and now you get an inductive kickback. All that stored energy in the magnetic field comes back as a great big spike. There's a 1B3 rectifier tube inside that high voltage cage to rectify that voltage, and out comes the 20,000 volts that really makes the cathode ray tube work. So studying the schematic diagrams of a black and white television set, let me drop. If you simply Google the word television, early television sets, black and white television, televisions with cathode ray tubes and whatever, I believe you're going to be able to find schematic diagrams. I believe you're going to be able to find websites that explain how the circuitry works. So everything you do with transistors today used to all be done with tubes in the old days. And the tubes themselves had all kinds of wear-out procedures. And so before you were born, almost every one of the drugstores you used to be able to go to and the major department stores had a tube testing apparatus in the store. People would every day, somebody else would be coming in with a bag full of the tubes out of his black and white television set. They would plug each one of them into this test fixture to find out which ones are good, which ones are weak, and he would go out and buy those tubes, plug them back into his black and white television in order to restore full performance, full deflection on the screen, and full sensitivity when you're doing reception and so on. So the wear out of those tubes was a big annoyance. And we've all forget about those days now that we've got transistorized television. So you can use it as a source of parts to do building of other circuits. There's a lot of capacitors, inductors, resistors, transformers, and all kinds of stuff inside that set if you decide to sacrifice it. To continue to use it, let me drop. To continue to use it as a black and white television, if you're a nostalgia enthusiast, somebody who likes the good old days, as they say, to keep it operational is one way to go. However, you're soon going to discover that once they added color television and high resolution and all the other good things we've got and a zillion channels of our modern-day television set, and you look at one of those modern-day color pictures and you realize how much information you're getting off that screen, and you go back to the older black and white set.
NBC.
And, okay, Bob's going to give us some more information on this one, too. K4NBC. Going to go to you in a second, Bob. And glad to hear that somebody is signing in from the outside world. You're going to find out that the black and white picture is not giving you quite as much information. It's good for the guys who like the good old days. Now, Bob, who has worked in broadcast for a whole lot of years, is going to tell us what it was like with the old-fashioned set, what he would do in this particular circumstance. Also, Bob, I believe you're signing in by way of Echolink or IRLP. And my guess is if we jump on top of each other and force the machine to time out, that you get a discontinued conversation, and that's one of the sources of annoyance that people who live out of the area have to live with. Confirm that hypothesis of mine, Bob, for me, Bob. K4NBC. You got it, Robert. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, Dick, and I'd like to say good evening to everybody on the net. I just wanted one, I'm confirming your theory there. Actually, it's practice. And two, I just wanted to say that I am so glad to see the end of the 6G H8A tube days. I used to buy them in quantity to keep the color on the screen there. And also, those old tube sets used to dry out the capacitors. They'd cook them, especially down here in Florida. So you had to stay on top of those circuits there in those old tube sets, or they would not work properly. Not for long anyway, a few years. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW from K4NBC on Echolink in the 6th borough.
Now, the 6th borough, by that do you mean, I think you're in Florida, Bob. Reproduce that for reconfirm that for me. I believe you're coming in from Florida, and if we're not careful to wait for all four beeps, you get periodically timed out, and for those who no longer sign in quite as frequently from the outer areas, it's that timeout annoyance that causes people to go away, not necessarily the information that we're discussing. That is a theory of mine. In other words, there are people who believe they don't like the material that we're discussing, and therefore they're dropping out. I think it's more likely the people from the outer areas are dropping out because of the annoyance of the timeout problem. I think you're confirming that. Is that true, Bob? And I think you are in Florida. K4 National Broadcasting Company, who you used to work for, K2RIW. You got it, Bob.
Roger that, Dick, QSL. Yes, I am in the borough of Florida, and for most of you folks up there are destined to retire to someday. When you get here, Dick, I'll help you put up your new tower. And, let me see. What else? I forgot the second part of your question, but anyway, yes, I am in Florida. Back to you.
And one last thing that people will find very interesting. I believe you're down to your last two, count them two, Rhone 55 towers of approximately 180 feet of altitude on your property. Am I approximately right on that one, Bob? Back to you, Bob.
Well, actually, I have one 190-foot Rhone 55. I have a 85-foot Rhone 25, which houses or accommodates the 10-meter repeater antennas. And I've got another Rhone 55 I'm looking to get up in the next few weeks now that we're having this nice weather down here, to wit, drought conditions and temperatures below 90 degrees, so there will be three towers up pretty soon. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW from K4NBC in the borough of Florida.
Fantastic, Robert. antenna-wise, you live in ham radio heaven. You've got it made. And as Seinfeld used to say, when you hit 65, you must retire to Florida. That's the law. That's what Mr. Seinfeld said, in a joking manner. So when I retire there, you're going to help me put up my towers. I can hire your helicopter to do the lifting of the antenna that gets put on the top, and so on. Look what you started here, Jim. So what? That black and white television, it's fun to learn about the old-fashioned tube-type electronics, but you got to be careful of the high voltage. And when it comes to the final performance of what you get off the screen, modern-day people have become so used to seeing a high-resolution color picture, they're not going to be as excited about it as you are. So how long you dwell with that particular mode of operation, whether or not you sacrifice it and use it for parts, those are some of the questions. Whether or not your Olympic television set represents an antique that's suddenly increasing in value, I kind of doubt it, but it's always possible. I'm not sure. Over to you, Jim. KD2BHY, KQLIW in the TechNet.
All right, I think I'm either going to turn it into an SSTV TV, or maybe I already took the batteries out now that you said that, all those scary voltage things. I took the batteries out, turned it off, but I think I'm just going to tinker with it and see what I can do.
Now, I guess I misunderstood. I didn't realize that your television set is battery operated. I assume that an old black and white television set is plugged into the wall, runs on 110 volts, and if yours is battery operated, even though it's black and white and small and compact, maybe it is, if it's battery operated, does it still have the high voltage? Is it a solid state screen on the front? I doubt it. I think it's a real cathode ray tube. Tell me the size of the screen on that television set, Jim. That'll give me a little bit more of a hint. Is it a 10-inch screen or a 30-inch screen? KD2BHY, KQLIW.
It plugs in and it's battery operated. It's around a 10-inch screen. I think I'm going to, 10-inch screen. Back to you.
Hey, kids, you don't listen as usual.
Yeah, there's something very valuable you've got in your hands there, Jim. I would have given you a lot of money to borrow that television set from you a few years ago, where I was doing an experiment where I was aligning one of my dish antennas to receive television. I was on top of the tower, tilting this antenna left and right, up and down as I locked it down, and I wanted to have a local battery-operated television set in my hand on top of the tower, so that I could see the picture and know when I was tuning the antenna the right way. And I didn't have that, and I had to do it by remote control with the television set down in the living room while I'm aiming the dish and talking to people on handy-talkies and saying, is the picture better? That's not the right way to do it. I needed a portable battery-operated television set that I could bring with me when I climbed to the top of the tower. So what you've got is a valuable thing there. And I didn't properly listen to everything you're telling me. So don't destroy that. Don't use it as parts. My recommendation is that's a nice thing that you can use in a lot of interesting ways. Keep it as is, and there are other ways we can get you the parts by which you can do experiments. And keep doing those experiments. It's a very educational hobby you're involved in, Jim. Back to you now, Alan. KCQRFN, ready for your real question. KQRIW in the TechNet.
KC2RSN, I just have to comment, man, 190 feet of tower, that's an incredible monster right there. That is a dream for him. Anyway, my question is, I've been getting into the CW side of the hobby, and in doing that, I've noticed that it's very crowded there. The signals are on top of each other, they fade in, they fade out. So I started to employ the filter system of the radio, which is mine is a Kenwood 570. And there's a noise blanker control. When I put the noise blanker setting number 2 on, it takes out a lot of the static. But I find that when signals are on top of each other, I will go to the first level of filtering, which is 1K. And what I've noticed is when that happens, when I put it onto 1K, the signal levels drop completely. Even if I'm on sensor frequency, let me just drop for a moment. Even if I know I'm on the center frequency of whoever's transmitting, how come when I flick the first layer of filtering on, even if it's just as broad as 1K, I notice a 75% drop in audio coming from the speaker, and I imagine that the signal has been attenuated by about that much. I also completely lose any kind of signal strength, because it seems to me if I'm only narrowing it by 1K, KC, and you know the whole signal is no wider than say anywhere from 150 to what 250 hertz. Why am I noticing a drop if I'm dead center on the frequency? And if I go lower, I can go down to 600, 500, and so on. I can have the filter on where even if I'm dead on frequency, I simply cannot hear the other side. I don't know if that's something wrong with my radio, or is that supposed to be what's happening? Over to you, Dick.
John, interesting question, Alan. There's a number of complicated things that could be going on. If the manufacturer, Kenwood, had done a real good job on these real physical filters, if there are real physical filters there, and we're not talking about digital signal processing to create a filter by an emulation program, a well-designed filter should have a very low insertion loss at its center frequency. And whether that filter is set up for 6 KC wide, 600 hertz wide, or 100 hertz wide, a well-designed filter should have almost the exact same insertion loss, so that when you switch to the filter and the signal is in the center, there should be no change in signal strength. And when you use more and more narrow filters to a beginning CW operator, you're able to take a zillion CW signals that are all crowded real close together and do more separation of them. Let me drop. The more narrow filter allows you to select the signal you want to listen to and reject all the others, and a well-designed set of filters should have the exact same insertion loss. So the signal should not, when you tune to the center of your desired signal, and you got it centered in the narrow filter, and then you sequentially go to the more and more broad filters, although you start hearing a whole lot of other signals coming in, the signal you're listening to, except for the AGC action, should stay the same amplitude. The fact that yours go very low in amplitude could represent either a poor design or an error in the way your particular Kenwood 570 is operating. Second of all, some of it could be perception. Whenever you use a more narrow filter, you will be receiving less noise in the background. That's physics. And as such, the band appears to get quieter and you think the gain is lower. Well, that's a matter now of doing some more careful measurement during the time that the signal you're listening to is keyed down and giving you a certain amount of S-meter deflection. Does that S-meter deflection, when you centered it first on the narrow signal and go to the broad, the narrow filter and go to the broad filters, does the S-meter deflection change? Can you confirm that it really is extra insertion loss? And does the manual claim that that should be happening? And when you look at the schematic diagram, as I said, well-designed filters all have the exact same insertion loss, and therefore when you select between them, you shouldn't be getting a change in gain. You will be getting a change in some of the AGC action because the total amount of noise in the background, your background noise when there were no signals present is going to change a whole lot as a function of filters. So you can see there's a bunch of funny things going on, and it's definitely worthy of some further investigation from my point of view, Alan. Is it an error with your particular serial number? Is that a design flaw? Is there something not quite working correctly? Maybe those other filters have a separate amplifier attached to them.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's possible that bank of more